The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts and a Regular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome back to Chasing Ghost after a hiatus during which the companion podcast, War Notes, a Conflict podcast, was published in the interim. I haven't published a new Chasing Ghost episode since November of 2024, so this year we're having our first one in this new year of 2025. This episode will be The Mexican Cartel Conundrum, War Without End. It is episode 058 of Chasing Ghosts. A little bit of housekeeping. So yes, I'm returning to my fortnightly cadence of issuing Chasing Ghosts, the War Notes companion podcast, which covered conventional warfare more so than irregular, hence the other podcast, so that I wouldn't sully the waters in the purity contest of Chasing Ghosts. Some housekeeping. If you have neglected to listen to War Notes, a Conflict podcast, in which I just completed the 12th episode of the Fixing Fight Club series, in which I take on the DOD, the Pentagon, the U.S., and the Western Marshall Complex, and challenge them with the notion of getting up to speed on 21st century warfare, because the peer conflicts that will occur, and it is inevitable that those peer conflicts will occur, are going to catch the United States military complex on its back foot, despite the $1 trillion plus that is spent per annum on it. And you'll note I did not use the term near peer and peer, because for 2025, I've discovered, because of the Houthis' activities in Yemen, sending the United States surface fleet running for its life in the Red Sea, that the notion of near peer, as a matter of fact, the notion of developing countries and third world countries not being on an equal footing with the U.S. and its allies is a falsehood. So from this point forward, when it comes to the conflicts that we'll be characterizing in the 21st century, I'll refer to all of them as peers in this peer conflict, especially with the degraded and overly expensive and always late and never on time nature of the American delivery of exquisite platforms and everything else. The word peer will suffice to describe all future conflicts in this century. I always look forward to hearing from my listeners. So if you wish to get in touch with me, that is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You'll find a list of references for this episode in the show notes, along with the email that I just told you about, and the link to get to my Substack, where I have a comments modality, so that once these podcast episodes are published, you can join the conversation and the community to either let us know what you think, comments on the episode itself, or even suggestions for future podcast episodes in the irregular warfare milieu that you'd like to see me entertain. So again, thank you. And if you happen to be listening to this on your favorite podcast venue, I would ask, with hat in hand, that you leave a good review if possible and spread the word to your friends about the very existence of this podcast if you think it meets a need. So thanks for that. Let's get on with podcast episode 058, The Mexican Cartel Conundrum, War Without End. So we find ourselves in a new year in 2025. This would be the first episode of Chasing Ghost broadcast in this new year under a new administration, with a very curious organization called DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, that is being helmed by no less than Elon Musk and his crew of worthies, and they are shining lights onto a variety of things that for generations have kept their secrets and have provided a very interesting and profitable money laundering nexus for the deep state. Now, this being the case, what we've also discovered is that the Pentagon for a generation has been incapable of bearing up under the scrutiny of an audit. As a matter of fact, they haven't completed an audit for the trillions of dollars that they have pocketed over decades, if not generations. And since 1945, as I am wont to remind my listeners, the Pentagon has a near-perfect record of defeat, stalemate, and inefficiency at delivering war victory in every conflict that the United States is involved in. So the new administration has floated a very interesting trial balloon, where by executive order or congressional edict or however this washes out in the end, the administration has the desire to take on the Mexican cartels in particular because of drugs and human trafficking and the problems that that is causing in the big demand sphere here in the United States. And there has been talk of sending military forces into Mexico. There has been talk of sending special operations forces. Commendably, the trigger pullers and the storied and legendary shooters of the Tier 1 community. That would be the community of Special Tactics Squadron from the Air Force 24, SEAL Team 6, CAG, formerly known as Delta, and the Army of Northern Virginia, which is the shadowy organization that provides the needed auxiliary support for CAG operations, the Ranger Regiment, which provides the external perimeter forces for a lot of the operations that CAG and others may engage in. The Marine Special Operations Command appears to be providing shooters for this. Now, remember, we do not discuss classified data on this podcast for many reasons, among which is I have neither the provenance nor the willingness to expose those kind of things. Nobody here has a need to know of things that are classified by the United States government. Everybody who is a perennial and persistent listener of this podcast knows that I find the classification regime in the intelligence community in the U.S. and with its allies and NATO and other organizations is, for the most part, a cover mechanism to cover up mishaps, mischiefs, accidents, malfeasance, and just sheer martial incompetence on the part of the forces that employ that classification regime to hide those excesses. So nonetheless, we will keep this plain vanilla. We will not do any of the sexy black op stuff. I'll leave that to others who are more steeped or willing to discuss those kind of things. So when we're talking here, we're talking on a sheerly speculative basis, because whatever numbers I may talk about with STS-24, with CAG, with SEAL Team 6 and others, sheer speculation on my part, like Tom Clancy, divined from unclassified and open source intelligence sources in order to arrive at the conclusions that we do. The pricey in the abstract is this, that the United States government now seems willing and able to entertain the notion of using elite special operations forces, the ones that I just mentioned, probably others, and send them in as shooters, assaulters, maybe doing rendition activities where they see someone who may be wanted dead or alive and seize him alive and bring him to rendition spots around the world or maybe to Guantanamo, whatever the purpose may be. But they seem to want to take our elite special operations forces and employ them against criminal cartels that are involved in drugs, human trafficking, contraband, and the smuggling of all kinds of things that aren't necessarily legal within the United States. First of all, to set the stage, I would like to deal with the facts that all of us can have a probably nearly a unanimous consensus on. Drugs, human trafficking, contraband that is provisioned by the cartels in Mexico, and by the way, those aren't simply Mexican cartels, but most likely an affiliation or confederation of various cartels from all over the world, as a matter of fact, not simply Latin America, but maybe triads that control Southeast Asian products, Middle Eastern products that would provide the means to get Afghan or possibly Iraqi hashish and those kind of things smuggled into the United States. Most of them, if they're using a black-on-black, which would mean a clandestine network that is dark from the beginning, dark to the end, and they're using these rat lines and pipelines, will probably come to the experts in crossing the United States southern border. Now, this isn't to say that the Canadian border isn't just as porous, but it just so happens by sheer density, truckload, shipping manifests, things like that, most of this trafficking occurs on the southern border into the United States. One of the reasons why the United States is one of the largest illegal and illicit drug users and users of human trafficking is because there is a big demand signal in the United States to do that very thing, and that in this case, the provisioners, those suppliers, the people who are willing to take the underground and black market risks to make that happen, tend to be centered in Mexico. Hence, Mexico is the locus, onus, and focus of the drug enforcement organizations in the United States, the intelligence community, and those kind of things. The logic would be that if we sent in military forces, that they would have a means above and beyond kinetically, more so than the drug enforcement, the DEA and the FBI and all the other alphabet organizations that have been involved in trying to stymie this drug trade ever since the 1972 DEA was formed by Richard Nixon, and it hasn't fared very well, this fight, this war against illicit drug use, because the demand signal in the United States is absolutely huge, and the profits available on underground, unregulated, decriminalized black markets is very large and attracts the usual rough trade and rough customers who are willing to take the risks to make it happen in order to supply this huge demand signal in the United States. It is out of bounds of the constraints and the scope of this podcast to talk about decriminalization, making drugs illegal, making drugs legal, and all of the things that attend to that. But in the end, the Gordian knot to be severed here is the demand curve. In this case, the demand signal, as I've mentioned before, is so high that people are willing to take tremendous risks to provide for the hundreds of thousands and millions and probably tens of millions of drug consumers of every stripe and socioeconomic strata in order to get their hands on this. Now, this isn't to say that there isn't a significant amount of drug production, especially marijuana, in the United States. You have places in Kentucky, Tennessee, Appalachia that produce vast quantities of marijuana. You have places from my old alma mater, Humboldt State University, which is now Cal Polytechnic Humboldt, which Humboldt, especially Humboldt County, the southern part where Garberville was and is one of the probably locuses in continental U.S. of very high-quality marijuana. And of course, with drug legalization, we've seen tremendous amounts of folks coming from underground and going above ground and creating legalized pot and other things. And of course, the state, through licensure and regulation and such, has found means by which they can make money on it. And inevitably, the economic demand signal for government finding that they can make money on this through regulation and taxation. California would be, for instance, where they have taxed and regulated it to such a large extent that the former black market for marijuana, which had dried up, which has all of a sudden seen a renaissance. As the old hands in Humboldt and all of the underground horticulturalists returned to their underground haunts to ply their wares, I happened to know someone who was a big grow manufacturer above ground who happened to work for one of the big distributors legally here in the United States. And at one point in the state of Oregon, not only did he have to weigh plants, but he also had nearly 56,000 individual discrete ARFIDs that he had to maintain on every plant in the grow facility so that Oregon and its state authorities and organs could not only track it, but tax it to the greatest extent possible. And what you discover with government is that if they legalize or decriminalize something, since decriminalization is the superior way to do this, but nonetheless, with the legalization process and the regulation, that it becomes so burdensome and it becomes so attractive to the government to use as an extraction device to get more tax monies and such, that they drive the price up, which of course causes people to go back to the former vendors and proprietor that were not above ground and were underground and provisioning them through the underground economies. So I don't quite know what to do about the demand signal in the United States, but what we do know for a fact is, number one, it won't go away. Number two, it is very lucrative at scale. And number three, all efforts since the early 1930s, when the Treasury refocused their efforts after prohibition on alcohol was repealed, and in 1933, those Treasury agents, once alcohol could be consumed by all Americans without government interference, started to cast their eyes on a number of drugs that they scheduled as either over-the-counter or illegal, and therefore controlled them with law enforcement violence, which, of course, didn't stop the organized crime and less organized crime syndicates from plying their wares and stepping into the breach to provision what was made illegal but wanted nonetheless. The Mexican drug cartels, which also included expats from Colombia, moving a lot of the primary cocainage from Colombia to Mexico, or at least a conduit thereof, Mexico controls approximately 70% of the foreign narcotics flow into the U.S. That's cocaine, heroin, and increasingly methamphetamine, and of course fentanyl and things like that. There are a variety of affiliated, associated, and disaffiliated cartels within the Mexican economy. Now, the two most significant cartels are the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel. These tend to be regional cartels that are dictated and labeled by where they are in the specific territories of Mexico. There is no way, of course, this being an illegal and underground economy with the heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, marijuana, and such. But you can more than guess that there are tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars involved here in provisioning for this trade illegally across the United States border. Now, the U.S. homicide rate is approximately 6 cases per 100,000 people. When it comes to the Mexican murder rate, that murder rate hovers at around maybe 25 to 28 per 100,000. Of course, the Mexican government has had an on-again, off-again relationship with the cartels in which they find themselves woven intimately and intricately with cartel relationships. Maybe not so much out of a willingness to do so, but a lack of willingness not to affiliate because of the level of violence that is employed by the cartels to maintain the kind of monopolies that they have across the board there. Now, you can note that Felipe Calderon, President Calderon, 2006 to 2012, declared war on the cartels shortly after taking office. With U.S. assistance, the Mexican military captured or killed 25 of the top 37 drug kingpins, and this militarized crackdown was a centerpiece of Calderon's tenure. However, some critics say Calderon's decapitation strategy created dozens of smaller, more violent drug gangs. Many also argue that Mexico's military was ill-prepared to perform police functions. Now, that is that's a happenstance across the world where not only does militarization of the police make for bad times for civilians, but the opposite doesn't work very well at all, where you try to have the military conduct police operations and behave not as soldiers but as constabulary. It makes for a recipe for disaster. Now, mind you, during that term, 2006 to 2012, it the government registered more than 120,000 homicides over the course of Calderon's term. That doesn't mean all of those homicides necessarily were involved with the drug trade, but we can take a guess that they were a proportionate amount of that, nearly twice as many as over his predecessor's time in office. I would urge you guys, if you get the opportunity, and I will provide a link in the show notes, to review some of the histories that are available that go over the Mexican government's dynamics and involvement and presidencies and how they have dealt with the illicit drug trade. That is sort of outside the scope of what we're examining in this particular podcast episode, because I'm scoping this episode simply to talk about the U.S. military, maybe allies to the U.S. military, getting involved in military functionalities, both above board and not, to include rendition activities and things like that. And I'm not necessarily talking about what the law enforcement activities are, how to reduce the demand signal in the United States, how to reduce the supply capabilities of the provisioners in Mexico, sort of outside the scope of the brief time we're going to take to address the efficacy and the usefulness of employing the American military against the cartels in Mexico proper. Now, I always like to employ analogies. Let's suppose that cartels, and they are here, but they were wildly violent, just as promiscuous in the drug and human trafficking trade, but in CONUS, not Mexico, not Canada, but in CONUS, how would the American government and the American people feel if the Mexican and Canadian governments were so incensed by what was going on that they took military action within United States borders to help to curb the violence, the drugs, the human trafficking? I don't think that that is ever received well by the receiving government. So in this, I want to make a few things clear that I would state as fact. Here are some of those facts. The cartels are in Mexico. The cartels are part of the Mexican government, whether you acknowledge that or not. And when I say this, I'm not saying that it is an open policy of whoever is at the head of the Mexican government, the president and the criminal enforcement and military organizations, that they are wedded, bedded, and in partnership actively in the daytime with the cartels. The point that I'm making is this, is that the cartels have such an outsized financial and violence-driven influence on everything that happens in the Mexican political ecology that I am certain there is a two-digit percentage of folks in the political spectrum who are either able auxiliaries looking the other way or actively engaged in assisting the cartels in their drugs and human trafficking activities from Mexico into the United States. So we can state all of those things as facts. We can also state this as a fact. For nearly a quarter century, in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, Libya, Syria, and various other neo-imperialist mud pits planet-wide, the U.S. has waged counterinsurgency, an insurgency on occasion, counter-guerrilla, and a guerrilla on occasion, what one could call hybrid and gray zone warfare, to include FinCEN, the financial accountancy center that is used to analyze illegal money trafficking, how money flows go to terrorist organizations, drug organizations, and things like that. So I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues. He will go by the initials JB, and he provided me with some interesting discussion points, some things to consider in this conflict. One of the things he says it took nearly two decades to understand and appreciate our enemies in the ME in the Middle East. I was just discussing that quarter century of counterinsurgency that was routinely and in the end quite unsuccessful in achieving the ends that they sought to, despite all the lives lost, all the bodies maimed, and the trillions of dollars used. And he says, in a majority, if not all of our assumptions were wrong, what does that mean for the future against the cartels? they can replace fighters faster and easier than a mujahideen because they don't have to recruit into an ideology. They just pay them and or threaten their families. Now, mind you, I'm not saying that in the fight against the ideologies and the Muslim religionist in the Middle East didn't include payola and didn't include folks who were enlisted into the ISIS ranks for pay, or specialists were brought in to do that very thing. But I would say he has a great point here. What he's pointing to is that not only is, and I wouldn't say it's absent ideology, I would say it's absent the kind of ideology that Westerners who live above ground in ecology of laws and law-abiding citizens can't quite grok or realize the ideology of these criminal cartels. They will never run out of bodies. Now, I can say the same thing for Muslim jihadists and such in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, where pay isn't necessarily there, but they will never run out of willing young men who will come to the call and join in the operations of violence that they engage in. The same thing applies here. We've seen the movies about sicarios. We've read the books. We've seen the articles. We've seen the violence. We've seen the bodies hanging off of bridges in Mexico. We've seen the absolute horrific torture atrocities that they will commit against people. But absent having a Bukele, and Bukele has circumstances in El Salvador that are very unique to him, that would not encourage or enable a Bukele-like response to the Mexican drug crisis, in part because his is a much smaller country and his is a very focused campaign that is working for his particular socioeconomic strata, not the case for Mexico. Mexico, like the United States, is not a singular unified country. It is a country that is divided by dialect. They are divided by region. They are divided by different sympathies. They are divided by different kinds of environments and ecologies that inform how those localities and regions conduct their business, both above ground and below ground. He goes on, and he and I are both students of international terrorism. If we think named terrorist organizations have global reach, what do you think the cartels have? And in spades, it's practically part of their operation. And the point that he's making here is that there are very sophisticated relationships planet-wide when it comes to logistics, transportation, warehousing, wholesale-level operations, retail-level operations. This entire span of control that is needed for the cartels planet-wide, not simply servicing the U.S. economy, gives them access to lines of communications and supplies and a not only a willingness, but a real native wit and capability when it comes to moving forbidden product, hiding forbidden product, and distributing that forbidden product in an entire underground ecology that they swim in that, for the most part, most Americans have no clue how that works. And most of the time in the United States, it happens right under their nose. JB goes on, for every action we take, there will be an equal or greater reaction from the cartels in terms of violence, also part of their operations, because they simply don't care. And he's correct. Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfracker, and it is going to take its toll on any organizations within the United States, whether governmental or extra-governmental, because the cartels don't stop at targeted operations. The cartels have an ecology of fear. They have an ecology of persuasion that is beyond the reach of most ordinary organizations, excepting intelligence organizations, which, through such cute phrases as enhanced interrogation and such, do engage in torture activities. After all, let's remember it was the U.S. Army in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War at the end of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century who started employing waterboarding on a wholesale basis usually resulting in the deaths of half the people who were waterboarded at the time, to include men, women, and children in the Philippines. And for the most part, the cartels and the drug organizations and the human trafficking organizations don't employ torture to extract information because they swim in a sea of information that they can have access to practically anything they want if they find the right people who will do it for payola. In this case, torture is used as a control mechanism. It is used as a fear card. It is used as a means to keep everybody in line, aligned, and affiliated with what their end state and end goal is, which is making sure that the demand signal is met in the United States in this case. JB goes on, tactically, we can win in a gunfight. There's no question. I agree with that. But that's the wrong question. What we should be asking is, do we even need a gunfight? Can we achieve our objectives without repeating the global war on terror strategy that ended so poorly around the world? Sure, there will be gunfights, but let's not make headhunting the main objective. It doesn't work. And to JB's credit, he is correct. Headhunting won't work because for every cartel leader or soldado or sicario or member, wherever they are, much like the IRA and much like other the ETA with the Basques and all these other organizations, people are queued up and standing in the wings waiting for one guy to get his head lopped off so they can step in and take his place. They're almost doing this in the Roman legionary fashion, where once they were engaged in a very vicious fight with the others, they had formed their shield wall and they were hacking and hacking. The centurion at the back would blow his whistle, and that man who had been holding on to the guy in front of him would step into the breach and start his hacking and slashing. They are queued up and waiting. You cannot eliminate the supply signal if the demand signal remains as keen and lucrative as it is now. And he says, related to four, cartel networks of informants, collaborators, and other forms of intel are way better than ours. They have spent decades systematically getting access and placement during the war on drugs. Don't bet on surprise. We will need overwhelming speed and violence of action, which, of course, is a specialty of our Tier 1 operators, our special operations forces like CAG, SEAL Team 6 and stuff, probably some of the best assaulters and shooters on Earth. No doubt in my mind that that is the case. Does that mean that the surgical precision and the violence of action that they can bring to this will stem the tide of the incoming drugs and human trafficking across the border? I think not, because they're stepping into the breach by focusing a kind of violence on the cartels that the cartels deal with every day. Because the cartels, their coin of the realm, is violence. A kind of violence, a kind of extreme violence, in which it is the ocean they swim in. And if the Tier 1 forces come in, it will be yet another coin of the realm that they're very conversant in. And I want to tell you something else. When it comes to Tier 1 operators, as I said, I'm going to give them their street cred. Some of the best shooters on Earth, some of the best breachers on Earth, some of the best assaulters on Earth. Maybe comparable levels, smaller density of competence, but comparable levels could be found in the British SAS or the French GIGN. Maybe some of the commando with a K units that the Germans have. Maybe some other smaller units. I hear the Singaporeans are quite adept when it comes to this. But nonetheless, there's a small density, even in a place as rich and large in population as the United States. There's only so many people that can be the volunteers who make it through all the assessment and selection and get to there. For the sake of the fact that I have friends and organizations there, I don't want to bandy about numbers, but I'm here to tell you that these men don't number in the tens of thousands. But here's the worst news of all, is that if you take on the cartels, as JB alluded to, they have extraordinary intelligence. As a matter of fact, they probably have the best intelligence money can buy. They probably have better intelligence than money can buy, because In some cases, not only do they have more money concentrated in smaller places, but they are operationally and strategically purchasing folks who have an influence throughout the socio-political realm in the United States and all the associated markets planet-wide. For instance, if the Mexican cartels are dealing with the triads or Asian gangs throughout Southwest Asia and Japan, Korea, maybe the Philippines as a minor player in places like that, they have the means to, working at the wholesale and the retail level, find the muscle that they need at the time, use the money to grease the palms that they do. These people have a lubricity of access to information and influence that goes beyond anything most governments on earth, even the vaunted United States, has, in that if this were to occur, I would suggest to you this is going to be a peer competitor. When I use the term peer or near peer, for those who have been listening to my podcast for a while, I have stopped using the term near peer because I've discovered, as a result of what the Houthis in Yemen are doing with the United States Navy by laying them low in the Red Sea and sending them with their tails between their legs, it's foolish for me to employ the term near peer. Even the Houthis are a peer to the United States Navy, and by extension, maybe to the entire U.S. and European military apparatus, much less the Middle Eastern military midgets that are operating in the area. Remember that Saudi Arabian-American coalition against the Houthis in Yemen has been fired up since 2016. It is one of President Obama's legacies, not only to open up a war front in Yemen, but to open up the war front in Libya and Syria. So in this case, they have a global connection. They have a global construct. We can send the small density of shooters there, but what you're doing is this. For a military operation to take place in Mexico, you're doing two things which are very problematic. Number one, you are violating, even though you may have agreements from the Mexican government, you are violating in an unsanctioned war footing the Mexican territorial integrity by going after the cartels on their own turf and soil in Mexico. And you are basically waging a war against the Mexican government because you will find Mexican badges, Mexican ranks, and Mexican members of various organizations from banking to politics that will be in the pocket of the cartels. And inevitably, in these alleged surgical hits by the U.S. military, by some of the best shooters and assaulters on planet Earth, there will be collateral damage, there will be casualties. But let's do this. Let's suspend our disbelief and think that they're going to go in there and they're going to be 0 for 0. They're going to be 0 for 1. They're going to be 0 for 100. What I'm saying here is that they're not going to harm a single hair on the head of an innocent woman or child in all of their operations. Nothing stops the cartels from harming hairs on heads of women and children or innocent men and blaming it on the military shooters that come in riding on their high technology, exquisite platforms, rolling into the areas and employing UAVs, could be mud-to-space technology for location and such, but as everybody who has ever listened to this knows, and if you've been paying attention in the Middle East, there will be collateral damage and ground casualties that will be appended to the ledger of the United States and not the cartels, because they will lay the blame on them. Here's another guarantee I have. The videographers in the Middle East, whether they were Iraqi, whether they were Libyan, whether they were Afghan, whether they were one of the tribes in Afghanistan, whenever they detonated IEDs, whenever they used surgical hits with rifles against the military occupiers or the civilian aides or three-letter agencies personnel who were in country, they would usually record this in videography. They would usually be able through in the information sphere to absolutely dominate it as far as the influence operations that they used by filming the hits, filming the IEDs, having the lovely Islamic music, whatever one was playing in Iraq or Afghanistan, and the poetic scripts describing the war against the occupier, the war against the aggressor. Because here's what I assure you will happen. If the military goes into Mexico, the cartels are also influence peddlers. The cartels are also information operations experts. They will do everything in their power, and there's a lot of power there, to make sure that any kind of military incursion, whether it is a low-density incursion by a few shooters or maybe a platoon company or possibly battalion minus strength of U.S. military, will be perceived as invaders. They will be perceived as people who take advantage of women and children. They will be perceived as thieves, because let's remember what the three legs of the triad are for a successful insurgency. It is narrative, it is grievances, real and perceived, and it is legitimacy. What you see in township after township, especially in the northern and southern regions of Mexico, that much like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the ETA and other organizations throughout Europe and the Middle East, is that these alleged terrorist organizations will provision through shadow governments and donation causes and such. They will create governing forces themselves, and they provide for the people. Because they've done that, they find themselves allied with the people, and the people provide them with auxiliaries. They provide them with witting and unwitting support. And also, the very notion of having American military forces in Mexico again after the festivities in 1846 through 1848 and the festivities at the turn of the 20th century and Pershing's expeditions in the teens at the turn of the 20th century. They have long memories in Mexico. As a matter of fact, let's suppose that they don't have those long memories, but nonetheless, those memories can be stirred anew by sophisticated information operations by the Mexican cartels. And let's do some of the brass tacks here. So the shooters go in, and it's going to be either Tier 1 shooters or military organizations. All of a sudden, the 101st Airborne goes in there with a battalion-strength air assault from the Texas border or whatever the case may be. When that happens, how do you stop collateral damage? And by the way, if they happen to be engaged with paramilitary or maybe peer military forces that possess manpads, which would be man-portable air defense devices, or they've gotten a hold of javelins and anti-tank weapons and such, and the American forces come in there, helicopters, maybe they come in with IFEs, maybe they come in with tanks, and all of a sudden those things are shot down or cooked off, what happens then? As a matter of fact, what happens with combat search and rescue? What happens if a platoon or one of our vaunted Tier 1 organizations finds itself pinned down in a Mogadishu-type situation? How is combat search and rescue and medical and TCCC, which is tactical combat casualty care, how is that administered on a basis where you will have a free landing zone where one can land the combat search and rescue assets to dust off casualties or bodies or whatever the case may be? And then all of a sudden it does turn into Mogadishu, and it just so happens, whether American forces do this or the cartel forces do this and women and children die, what's going to happen is this. Either the women and children are going to die as a result of friendly fire by the Mexican forces, friendly fire by the cartel forces, or the characterization of threat fire by the American forces, which can be laid blame upon for the maiming and killing of women and children. Here's what will happen, and this is the characterization that always happens in all of these kind of conflicts, is that in these kind of societies, now when I would describe these societies with the blood clan and religious affiliations that they would have, then how could that be exploited by the cartels here? Well, what you would have is they would characterize the invaders as what? Invaders. They would be able to call them rather despised. They could make up all they want about the horrible things that American military forces will do to them. Because remember, this is all about perception. This is all about messaging that their fellow Mexicans, who happen to be in the cartel or in the political realm of the Mexican government itself, none of them will take kindly to a foreign invader who has a history of invading their country. As a matter of fact, has a history, again, in their perception, of taking part of their country away from them, in this case, Texas, New Mexico, parts of Arizona, parts of the media weaving that will have to take place on the part of the Americans to prevent this from happening. I don't know if we have the power or the wherewithal to make that happen successfully. Now, so I've described to you why I think the circumstances will be so poor and why on the ground there will be no assent by the population to the incursion by the United States militarily to go in there. So let me take this to the next level. What will be the cartel response to Tier 1 surgical removal or rendition and seizure activities of cartel VIPs, members, could be soldado, could be sicarios, could be any number of people, could be auxiliaries that are involved in finance or whatever the case may be. What will be the cartel response to that? So I describe briefly what happens down in Mexico with bodies hanging from bridges, people tortured, people cleaved in half, people having hands and legs cut off, and all manner of just absolutely horrific things happening to people who cross the cartel in a way that the cartel does not like. Here's my assurance, and I hate this because it's bloody morbid, but if these Tier 1 operators go in, and if the military goes in, not only will they be eminently targetable by the cartels themselves, but the cartels will know the soft underbelly of the beast here. And that would be families, that would be friends, that would be children, that would be the relations and the relationships that all these members of the military have, much less by extension, the political facilitators in the domestic U.S. political market who sign off on these kind of things and make this happen. They will be targetable and they will be targeted, and terrible things will be happening in the United States in retribution for military activity in Mexico on behalf of the U.S. government to try to stop this from happening. I think that will lead to a cycle of violence that will cause a declaration of war on Mexico to be a political necessity, and then we will find ourselves embroiled in a ground war with Mexico. We will find ourselves embroiled in a ground war with a country that is contiguous with the United States. For the first time since 1814, when the White House was burned down August 24th of that year, for the first time when attempted firebombings and naval gunnery from submarines by the Japanese on the Pacific coast took place in World War II. And by the way, on the East Coast during World War I, there were U-boats that would shell various targets on the U.S. shoreline. For the first time since those incidents, there will be a contiguous land war in America, and it will be a fight that will be red in tooth and claw. And again, we have the demand signal for the drugs and the human trafficking. Because if you stop that demand signal, and by no means do I think that is within the scope of my inquiry here, that's what would prevent this from happening. But since that's not within my scope, and I'm confining myself to an analysis of what's going to happen if the U.S. employs military force against the Mexican government, which is, by extension, an affiliate of the cartels, whether we acknowledge that or not, that is going to lead to greater and greater retaliation that will give a casus belli to members of Congress and the American government, especially with the kind of terrorism that will be practiced by the cartels and their affiliates in the United States, not only on military families, not only on political families, but all of the collateral damage that will occur as a result of those hits. I suspect what you will see is opportunities for IEDs, for vehicle-borne IEDs, for human-borne IEDs, for messing around with the decrepit and arthritic American infrastructure in ways that could collapse local or state economies. And, of course, as I've covered in episodes 37, 41 through 43, and 49 through 50 in my Storming America series, where I talked about an upsized, outsized, and retaliatory strike by Mohammedans in the United States with 1,000 cells of 10 men, and what would happen there. What happens, and you know I consider that to be a when and not an if, what happens if we start a military conflict with Mexico? The cartels become embroiled, and we know that the cartels, being underground networks, probably have affiliates, relationships, and open communications channels with terrorist organizations all over the world, since terrorist organizations all over the world happen to use these trades, drugs and human trafficking, not only to profit by, but when it comes to human trafficking, getting their folks, their soldiers, their males, their military age males, into the target countries, into their sleeper cells and such. What happens if this military incursion into Mexico not only results in retaliatory strikes by the cartels, but results in a kind of relationship between the cartels and the Islamists, who they have escorted across with coyotes, the porous before 2025 U.S.-Mexican border and U.S.-Canadian border? What's going to happen when they start cooperating? What's going to happen when they start outsourcing to each other terror elements, terror incidents, and even the suborning of various large American cities as a result of what they can do? So in the end, here's what I suggest to everybody who is listening to my podcast, is that it sounds really sexy to say that we're going to send in our big, beefy, top-of-the-line carnivores, the Tier 1 guys, the assaulters, as I've mentioned in this podcast and other ones before, some of the best of breed, some of the most able and accomplished killers of our age. We send them in. We have to remember that we have to extrapolate the second and third order effects of whatever we do, because I assure you, especially this being the U.S. government, when it comes to creating cavalcades of calamities, when it comes to creating chaos avalanches, when it comes to taking a grenade, removing the pin, and putting it in your pants and thinking that you're invincible because nothing will happen, that's not the way it has worked out the last century. That's especially not the way it's worked out the last two generations. So what I'm urging everybody to think about here is that America is in a place where if we were to do this thing that sounds so sexy and that so many people have fantasized about in Hollywood scripts and Hollywood movies, and boy, if we could just take this fight to the enemy that has the supply to meet this enormous demand signal for human trafficking and drugs and whatever else is smuggled across the border, we would do well to reconsider. We would do well to make sure that we have hired all the right people, the 10th men and the red teaming that I always talk about, so that we can extrapolate these second and third order effects and ensure that we don't open up a Pandora's box that is much more costly than what we thought it would be. I thank you for your listenership and consideration. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That's cgpodcast@pm.me. In the show notes for this podcast, you can go to my Substack and you can go to the comments function there and provide your salutary comments, recommendations for future episodes possibly, and other things. And also, welcome back to Chasing Ghosts. I'm really happy to be back to the podcast that animates me so. And be assured, until I assume room temperature, I have hundreds of episodes in me. So I look forward to your communications. If you happen to be on your favorite podcast vendor, please be sure to leave stars or a review. Recommend me to friends. Again, no hat in hand. And a thanks to all my paid subscribers, but all of my information is for free. I am indebted to my paid subscribers for parting with their hard-earned dollars to give them to me, to provide me with the means and the resources that I need to make this podcast better and better every time. This is Bill out.